AP Radio News. I'm Rita Foley. Hillary Clinton could steal some of Donald Trump's thunder on this day after the Republican National Convention. She may reveal the name of her running mate. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren's name's been mentioned.
I think if it were me, I would know it by now, so probably not.
She was on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. So who will it be? Our Jerry Bodlander's been looking into that.
Sources say Virginia Senator Tim Kaine has emerged as a leading contender. He sidestepped the issue when asked about it yesterday.
I'm a happy senator. I'm not looking for another job.
Kaine is a former governor of Virginia, one of several states that'll likely decide the election. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack reportedly is also under consideration. A pair of Democratic sources say that Clinton has not finalized her decision, which could be announced today or tomorrow as she campaigns in Florida.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump is now officially the Republican Party presidential nominee after his acceptance speech last night at the convention in Cleveland. He laid out his agenda.
Safe neighborhoods, secure borders, and protection from terrorism. There can be no prosperity without law and order.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is calling for a new anti-doping commission to be created to shape Russia's future strategy as the country faces possible exclusion from the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. A World Anti-Doping Agency report alleges state-sponsored doping and cover-ups in Russia. A new survey appears to show Britain's economy is shrinking at its fastest pace since the global financial crisis in early 2009, the result of the vote to leave the European Union, according to the survey. The Dow is down 10 points. This is AP Radio News. Patrol car video shows a white Austin, Texas police officer violently throwing a black woman to the ground during a traffic stop, followed by another white officer telling her black people have, quote, violent tendencies and whites are justifiably afraid. The traffic stop happened a year ago, but the video's just been released.
Stop resisting. Stop resisting right now. Get out of the car.
I'm getting out. Let me get out. Do not touch me.
Austin Police Chief Art Acevedo says a criminal investigation's been opened against the officer who arrested the woman. There will be a funeral today for Baton Rouge Police Officer Matthew Gerald, one of three officers shot and killed on Sunday by a black military veteran whose internet videos called for violence in response to what he considered oppression. I'm Rita Foley, AP Radio News.
Now today's top federal headlines. Congress may be on vacation, but members of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee are keeping busy. Chairman Jason Chaffetz and Ranking Member Elijah Cummings unveil legislation to expand whistleblower protections for subgrantees and personal services contractors. The committee also sent letters to 18 agencies requesting info on Hatch Act compliance. The Pentagon updates its 2015 Law of War manual. It scraps the portion of it which compared certain activities of journalists to spying or hostile acts. The changes come after media organizations voiced concerns over them. DOD General Counsel Jennifer O'Connor says the department's aim is to defend the very freedoms that journalists exercise. And the FBI doesn't have an objective way to review and prioritize cyber threats. That's according to the Justice Department Inspector General. The FBI has an annual process to identify cyber threats and direct resources to them, but the IG says the process is subjective and open to interpretation. Find these stories and more at federalnewsradio.com. I'm Eric White.
Are federal and postal workers and retirees really sweating the upcoming election? Do they have good reason to fear for their jobs, or maybe even flee the country if the wrong person, that would be you-know-who, wins? This is Federal News Radio, senior correspondent Mike Causey. Many agree the country is in big trouble. They just disagree on who the evil you-know-who is. Washington, the city of the worried well, is, well, worried as per usual. But before you book a November flight to Moose Jaw, Canada, or bury gold in your backyard, remember who you predicted back at the beginning would be the Republican nominee this month. Be honest, because almost all the pros and talking heads were wrong. And did you think an independent from Vermont could come as close as he did? So how good are the predictions of gloom and doom if you know who, him or her, wins in November? Sign up for my column and all our email alerts at federalnewsradio.com/alerts. I'm Mike Causey.
Selling to the government made easier thanks to the Coalition for Government Procurement. FederalNewsRadio.com. Search Off the Shelf.
Volunteers and donations are vital to Boys and Girls Clubs. Hi, I'm GEICO Vice President Renthia Ross, a volunteer and board member of the Fairfax County Boys and Girls Clubs. With the care and support of the Boys and Girls Club, I realized my dreams to go to college and become a lawyer. I urge you to give to two of our premier clubs, Butler Wyatt Boys and Girls Club and the Fairfax Boys and Girls Club. Please go to their websites and give generously, because investing in the future of our youth is a policy we can all be proud of.
Welcome to Agency of the Month, sponsored by HPE on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
Mail goes nowhere without mail handlers and carriers. The Postal Service has hundreds of thousands of such employees in several unions. For many, it's a lifetime job. At headquarters, ensuring the vitality of this workforce falls to the USPS Chief Human Resources Officer, Jeff Williamson. He explains the scope of the work.
So we are responsible for all employee-related policy, labor relations, compensation, benefits, and engagement for all 630,000 postal employees.
And it's interesting, the labor relations. My understanding is that in general they're pretty good at postal service. What are the big issues in labor management with respect to, say, the letter carriers and the union employees?
We have four large unions. We have two letter carrier crafts, our city carriers as well as our rural carriers, and then we have our clerks, our American Postal Workers, and our mail handler unions. They all bring different issues. However, over the last few years, we've actually built a very strong relationship with our unions and are in the midst of collective bargaining with three right now and just secured a ratified contract with our rural contract for the first time in over 20 years.
How many people altogether is that? Just refresh our memory.
Our craft runs a little over 450,000 career, and then we have another 100,000 non-career employees that the unions govern.
I didn't realize there's a difference between the urban and the non-urban or rural. Is there an actual difference in the job?
It's slightly different. I mean, delivery is delivery. However, in the city, delivery typically high-rise, more urban area, whereas rural traditionally has been longer routes, people in vehicles that could traverse as much as 100 miles or as, you know, little as, you know, 40, depending on the day. So the delivery is pretty much the same. However, some of the demands of the job are a little different.
And does the Postal Service have to recruit people for these craft jobs, or do people come to you?
Well, a little bit of both. You know, we have a strong career workforce, and it's been a fantastic job for many people for decades. So we have a lot of demand seeking employment for the Postal Service. However, in certain locations where the employment is a little bit tighter, we do recruit. We recruit right out of college, right out of high school. We recruit a lot of military. So we do have active recruiting efforts going on an ongoing basis.
And what kind of training and development is required for someone to become a carrier, you know, someone one of the craft-type jobs?
It's actually quite extensive. You wouldn't quite realize it, you know, when it comes right down to, you see there are vehicles on the road, right-hand drive. So we put them through extensive carrier academies to teach somebody how to drive a vehicle in this country with the steering wheel on the right-hand side, as well as the demands. When you think about, you know, the different products and services that we offer, as well as the demand of how do you receive your mail in the office in the morning, put it in, you know, the vehicle, and then actually traverse your route. Not to mention, obviously, the safety components with, you know, ensuring that you fulfill your duties on a daily basis, you know, in the most utmost safe way.
A few years ago, there was a spate of incidents involving carriers after dark in certain parts of the country, certain neighborhoods. What is the trend of that kind of thing happening? Some attacks, really. Right. Is that on the rise? Is it leveled off? Was that just a cluster of incidents that really wasn't a trend?
For us, I think safety is always a top priority. And when you think about the demands of having 200,000-plus employees on the street every day, six, sometimes 7 days a week, these incidents unfortunately do happen. But our carriers are trained. They're trained as to how to respond. The most important thing that we train our carriers on is situational awareness, whether that's at 8 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Understand your surroundings. Understand how to be safe as you go about your duties. And then the most important important thing for all of our employees is that they return safely at the end of the day.
So the folklore aside, the bigger danger is human beings as opposed to dogs.
Absolutely. Obviously, dogs are a big part of what we train our carriers on, how to protect themselves. This is where the American public can really help, quite frankly. You know, make sure your pets are secure on your property. You know, as customers, you know, you have a responsibility to help make sure that our carriers are safe as well. But it really depends. It depends on weather, depends on the geography and the terrain. Obviously, being out all day long, as far and as wide as we are, there are hazards that come along with the job. And we train our carriers to be very prudent, pay attention to their surroundings, and understand what to do to be safe. And that's their top priority.
We're speaking with Jeff Williamson, the Chief Human Resources Officer at the Postal Service. Now, one of the issues, not really a carrier issue or letter carrier issue, but a financial issue with respect to their long-term health care costs. This has been in the news over and over and over again, that contributes to those losses that the Postal Service incurs. And the Postal Service has been seeking legislative changes for a long time now, and somehow the conversation never seems to end.
Right.
So I guess that's a good sign with respect to Congress. What is it you need this year if you could have a perfect legislative package?
Wow, if I could pick it, it really comes down to four key things. And we've been true to these four items. The first does address some of our retiree health benefit issues. And it really allows the Postal Service, like any private company would do, is to fully integrate our retiree health care plans with Medicare, which would require Medicare to be the primary payer and our plans would be secondary. We can do that within the FEHB system. It's a plan that our unions have endorsed. It's also a plan that would allow our employees, the vast majority in retirement, to see lower costs out of pocket. And it would allow us to take advantage of being the second largest payer or the second highest contributor into Medicare over the last, 30 years. The second thing that's critically important to us is pension reform. Not so much changing the pensions and the benefits, but ensuring that OPM uses postal-specific demographics and assumptions when they calculate what our liability is. We believe as a self-sustaining and self-funding organization that our long-term liabilities should be based on the demographics of our workforce and the salary growth assumptions of our workforce, not of the rest of the federal government, because we are quite different. The third element is the pricing component. We just recently, unfortunately, had to roll back.
At 2 cents.
It was exactly a 4.3% exigent surcharge that was placed on all of our market dominant products. The PRC required us to roll that back in last April. We're actually requesting that be reinstated. That's worth over $2 billion to us on an annual basis. And then the fourth piece, which again is critically important, as the market changes, as our demographics of our marketplace shift, is allowing us some additional product and service flexibilities. Today, we are somewhat constrained by law in terms of the products and services that we can offer.
And so you would offer, if you could...
Well, so we would look at, from a digital standpoint. Right now, we don't have the latitude to really innovate and offer different types of digital solutions, whereas under an expanded offering beyond just beyond core postal products, we would have the ability to enter different lines of business. And again, as we've seen 27% of our total volume decline, 35% of our first class, our most profitable product decline, any business who is self-sustaining would look at other avenues that are tangential to what we do, however, could offer us opportunities to grow revenue.
I want to get back to that question of the demographics of the craft force that is widely different from the rest of the federal government. What does it look like? How do you characterize it?
Well, there's a couple of different components to it. The primary one that changes the liability calculation really is the salary growth. Again, under a collective bargaining agreement, our salary growth trends are slightly different than what the rest of the federal government sees. The second element is when you think about the longevity and lifespan of employees, in the different characteristics of an employee workforce in a more blue-collar environment, all we're asking for is that those demographics be taken into consideration when the calculations are being made.
And when people join in the craft side of Postal Service, they tend to stay a long time.
Yeah, I mean, the average age of a career employee is roughly 50 years old. So it is not unusual for us to be giving out 40-year service awards, 45, even 50-year service awards in many cases. In fact, as our last collective bargaining agreement in 2010 created a pathway to career status for new employees that we hire, we have converted into career almost 35,000 employees just last year. So it's a way into a federal career that has long-term benefits and many stay for decades.
Jeff Williamson is the Chief Human Resources Officer at the Postal Service. In part two of my interview, Williams discusses care and feeding of the technical and managerial postal employees. I'm Tom Temin.
The U.S. Postal Service understands what it means to deliver. That's why HPE Enterprise Services is proud to count the Postal Service as a delivery provider. HPE has the people, the capabilities, and experience to deliver IT solutions to the right place at the right time securely. HPE Enterprise Services is proud to partner with governments to transform their IT to better support the millions of citizens who rely on them every day. To learn how HPE can help you, visit hpe.com. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, accelerating next.
Competing as it does with the biggest and most innovative carriers, the Postal Service needs a workforce with equal talents and ideas. Care and feeding of the technology, engineering, and professional employees ultimately falls to the Chief Human Resources Officer at USPS, Jeff Williamson. In the second part of my interview, Williamson explains how Postal gets them in the first place.
We do extensive recruitment for more functional-based jobs, technical jobs. A classic example is we are a fantastic organization for industrial engineering. When you think about multiple type facilities, hundreds of facilities out there in a automated and in a mechanical way, we bring industrial engineers in. We hire, you know, right out of some of the most prestigious universities in the country, and they come right into an opportunity to look at lean techniques, work with Six Sigma activities in terms of projects, automation, and get some real hands-on experience on a scale that's hard to come by. In addition, you could look at HR within a functional HR organization, you know, as we hire people to come in and do recruiting, or we hire employees to come in and work on organizational effectiveness. Organizations the size and scale of ours create not only challenges but immense opportunities for people. The third element from a functional recruiting standpoint that we look at is we have an extensive leadership development program. And we believe that it's critically important not only to hire from the outside, but also to develop internally. So if you come in as an industrial engineer or you come in as an HR recruiter, you could have a path to an executive leadership team position in a different function because of our internal rotational programs, the way that we groom talent internally and build their leadership capability. So it offers immense capability from a career path standpoint.
About how many people do you take in a given year? Non-craft.
Non-craft. This coming year, we'll probably hire right around 1,000 to 1,200 into different roles. Again, we have management foundation programs where we're hiring this current class is roughly 60 right out of college to come into an 18-month management rotational program where they'll spend a little bit of time in IT, a little bit of time in HR, some time in finance, and then they'll outplace into a career position 18 months from now. And then again, as I said, we hire on a given year, you know, 50 to 100 industrial engineers, as well as the other functional needs that the organization has.
It must be a little difficult to describe what the Postal Service is, because on one hand, they're always saying we're not a federal agency, we're self-funded. But on the other hand, you can't do anything without Congress
right.
And the Postal Regulatory Commission. So it's really a hybrid kind of animal. How do you get people to get their heads around that idea?
I like to describe it as the best of both worlds. right? If you're up for a challenge, we have all the challenges of a private enterprise and a private business, and we have all the challenges of a government agency. We get to do it every day. So if you're up for opportunities to do things from a business standpoint on a large scale, you have them here. If you're interested in how politics influence government and government entities and some of the responsibilities that a government entity has, you have it here as well. So it really does run the gamut in terms of the day-to-day function of the organization. But we are that quasi sort of being pulled from both sides entity.
A lot of federal agencies, regular executive branch agencies, one of their big challenges is finding people that are qualified and skilled in federal procurement to work under the FAR and so forth and the Competition and Contracting Act. Postal Service has its own procurement system. Is that an issue for you also to find competent buyers?
Actually, no. It's been a challenge for us retaining some of our supply management experts. We have, again, as we go out and recruit, we recruit those in supply chain on an annual basis. We have extensive internal training. We also put them through other external training in order to bring up their proficiencies. We have a fantastic group here that does our procurement and supply management to the degree when you think about the contracts that they manage the scope, scale, and breadth of what they're involved in on an ongoing basis, they actually become extremely marketable skills. So as we, you know, look out into the future, we balance not only the immediate need to hire new talent with fresh skills, but also what are we doing to retain employees who have invested 5, 6, 10 years in some cases.
Now, many of the top executives at Postal Service, including the Postmaster General, have been here a long, long time. What about you?
I joined the Postal Service a little over 11 years ago.
So you're a newcomer.
So I'm a newcomer. I actually hit double digits, which is something that I'm actually very proud of because I didn't think that I would make it that long, quite frankly. But I joined the organization for many of the same reasons that we just talked about. The opportunities that you get when you come to an organization of this size and scale, if you're up for a challenge, there's plenty of them, and it's an organization that truly, truly is focused on its mission. And that's hard to say in many places, right? I mean, we get to come to work every day. I tell people I get up and I go to work and I try to improve the lives of 600,000 people and then every customer that they touch, which is every American every day. You can't beat that.
Jeff Williamson is Chief Human Resources Officer at the Postal Service. Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
The U.S. Postal Service understands what it means to deliver. That's why HPE Enterprise Services is proud to count the Postal Service as a delivery provider. HPE has the people, the capabilities, and experience to deliver IT solutions to the right place at the right time securely. HPE Enterprise Services is proud to partner with governments to transform their IT to better support the millions of citizens who rely on them every day. To learn how HPE can help you, visit hpe.com. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, accelerating next.
We're speaking with Jeff Williamson, the Chief Human Resources Officer at the U.S. Postal Service. What is the performance management challenge? Because you have the craft, the 400,000 craft employees out there, then somebody's got to make sure they're performing properly. A wholly distinct, I guess, challenge from those that are not in the craft. So how does the management disciplines and the performance management tools get pushed down out to that furthest rural carrier?
So what we have is, from a management standpoint, we are governed by a pure pay-for-performance system. We have an extensive system that aligns the goals of right from our frontline supervisors and postmasters all the way up to the postmaster general. They're defined very specifically at both their local unit and then link as you move up to our corporate goals. That's what we use in terms of aligning your day-to-day function with the mission and purpose and strategy of the organization. So it's those frontline supervisors and those frontline management ranks who really on a day-to-day basis ensure that our craft, whether you're a city carrier or you're a mail handler working in a plant, is focused on the right activities to drive the business result.
And, you know, the public probably interacts with the Postal Service more than with anyone else right. that is federal, quasi-federal, whatever you want to call it. And so what's your message to the public that that you would like them to know about the Postal Service, that everyone brings their preconceptions to it?
Well, we are, again, when you talk about somewhat being misunderstood, we're an extremely technically capable organization. And when you think about the ability to walk down the street and drop a letter in a blue collection box and a couple days later have it go from Washington, D.C. to California, most don't really think about what goes into it. So, again, the message is we have 630,000 dedicated people every day, some that work on the street delivering your product, some that work in the back office processing, some that work in collection and receipt. But then you also have 50,000 plus management officials across the organization, frontline supervisors all the way up to, you know, your leadership team here at headquarters that work tirelessly to manage and maneuver this organization in that quasi-government world where we're self-sustaining, we're not appropriated, we don't receive taxpayer dollars to manage our operations. And we run it like a business, but we do it, we believe, in a very responsible way. And at the end, we are purely focused on the mission of delivering that product and connecting Americans coast to coast.
In those rotational assignments for people that come in newly to Postal, does that include maybe not a rotation, but at least an observation of the postal sorting operations, the real highly mechanized postal sorting centers, and also maybe getting out on a route to see how carriers operate?
Yes, it's a critical part of those programs. Understanding and seeing what happens on a daily basis behind the curtain is really foundational to understanding how you can positively impact that. We have a very simple goal here in HR. Our job is to improve the employee experience, period. We believe that the great customer experience starts with a great employee experience, and I tell my team, you can't do that if you don't understand what they're going through on a daily basis, whether it's safety, actually understanding what it's like to walk a route and not necessarily know where that dog might come from or what other hazards might be on that route, or if you're working in a facility, the demands of unloading trailers at 2 o'clock in the morning. Not understanding that, seeing it and appreciating it doesn't allow us to do our job as effectively as we can. So those rotations, those observations, not just in the initial programs, but throughout your career, is absolutely critical to being effective in these jobs.
And how much vertical space is there for someone coming in at the bottom? In other words, if a carrier decides, I want to be management, I think I could really help here with right. vehicle acquisition or whatever the case might be, sorting equipment acquisition. Can they do that, and do they do that?
Well, I will just say this. Three of our last three Postmaster Generals and CEOs started at the very front of the very front line of the organization. So, yes, that is one of the selling points. You can come into this organization, and from an operations standpoint, sky's the limit. From a career standpoint, sky's the limit. It really is about where you want to go and what you want to do. And then obviously, you know, stepping in and succeeding in those roles when you're given those opportunities. But we have thousands of frontline supervisor positions, which is that first step from a craft position into management. And again, you see people who come in, they do a great job, learn the business, and they move very, very quickly.
Jeff Williamson is Chief Human Resources Officer at the Postal Service. Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin. Thank you for listening to Agency of the Month, sponsored by HPE. The entire show is available on demand on federalnewsradio.com. Search Agency of the Month.
The U.S. Postal Service understands what it means to deliver. That's why HPE Enterprise Services is proud to count the Postal Service as a delivery provider. HPE has the people, the capabilities, and experience to deliver IT solutions to the right place at the right time securely. HPE Enterprise Services is proud to partner with governments to transform their IT to better support the millions of citizens who rely on them every day. To learn how HPE can help you, visit hpe.com. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, accelerating next.
According to the American College of Cardiology, if you have heart disease, it's important to take a strong role in your own care. You and your doctor should manage your health condition together. Do your part and learn about your condition, ask questions at doctor visits, and make sure you understand instructions. It may help to bring someone to your appointments who can help you remember to take medications as instructed and follow advice about diet and exercise. For more information and stories from patients living well and with common heart conditions, visit cardiosmart.org.
What has the Federal Communications Commission done to transform its IT infrastructure? How has the FCC Chief Information Officer cultivated a network of change agents? What is the FCC doing to cultivate a culture of risk-taking and experimentation? Join host Michael J. Keegan as he explores these questions and so much more with Dr. David Bray, Chief Information Officer of the Federal Communications Commission, next week on the Business of Government Hour. Tune in Mondays at 11 a.m. for the Business of Government Hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
This is John Gilroy. My show, Federal Tech Talk, answers the question, how does technology make life easier for the federal audience? I've spent years interviewing federal CIOs, tech leaders, and big company CTOs. What they tell me is compelling, provocative, and always relevant to the federal government and contractor. Check it out Tuesday and Thursday afternoons at 1 on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., or download it anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Federal Tech Talk.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program is Jeffrey Rosen, constitutional law scholar and author of the recently published book, Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. Jeffrey Rosen is president and CEO of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, and that's an agency created by Congress to publish nonpartisan information on the Constitution, and he's also professor of law at George Washington University Law School. In his new book, Jeff Rosen dubs Louis D. Brandeis, who was appointed to the Supreme Court in 1916 by President Woodrow Wilson, the Jewish Jefferson. Rosen says it's because Brandeis was the greatest critic of the curse of bigness in both business and government since Thomas Jefferson, the author of the U.S. Declaration of Independence. The book was published to commemorate the 100th anniversary of Brandeis' Supreme Court confirmation. In Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet, Rosen further argues that Brandeis was one of the visionary constitutional philosophers of the 20th century. According to Jeffrey Rosen, Brandeis wrote the most famous article on the right to privacy and the most important Supreme Court opinions about free speech, freedom from government surveillance, and freedom of thought and opinion. And perhaps less well known about Brandeis, he was also the leader of the American Zionist movement, and he convinced Woodrow Wilson and the British government to recognize a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. We'll talk with Jeffrey Rosen about the Jewish Jefferson of the 21st century. Rosen believes that the life and achievements of the Supreme Court Justice can help us understand historic and contemporary questions involving the Constitution, monopoly, corporate and federal power, as well as technology, privacy, free speech, and Zionism. In addition to his positions at the National Constitution Center and George Washington University, Professor Rosen is also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and that's a public policy think tank, as well as a contributing editor for The Atlantic magazine. Jeffrey Rosen, welcome to the program.
It's great to be back.
Well, we are delighted to have you as well, and congratulations on your terrific new book.
Thank you so much.
Now, you call Louis D. Brandeis the Jewish Jefferson. Tell us why.
Brandeis was, as you said in your great introduction, the most important critic of bigness in business and government since Jefferson. Both Jefferson and Brandeis believed that only in small-scale businesses and small-scale democratic communities could citizens develop their faculties and achieve the personal and political self-mastery that was necessary for self-government. So Brandeis was a huge opponent of big corporations. He was the nemesis of J.P. Morgan and predicted the crash of 1929. And he also didn't like centralized government power. He voted to strike down parts of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and was a great champion of what he called laboratories of democracy in the states, where he thought that citizens could best achieve their potential.
Well, that tells us a lot about the Jeffersonian legacy. Now, what about the Jewish part? He is the first Jewish Supreme Court Justice, correct?
Correct.
talk about to what extent his Jewish faith may have informed him as a lawyer and a Supreme Court justice. I know from your book that he wasn't brought up in a particularly very Jewish household. His family was very secular. Talk about that.
They were secular. Brandeis's mother raised him to believe that ethics was more important than religion, and they had no special Jewish identity, although they didn't renounce their upbringing. His parents were from Prague. They fled the failed liberal revolutions of 1848 in search of liberty and America, and the burning passion of the Brandeis family was books and music and intellectual and ethical development. But around 1910, Brandeis unexpectedly, in his late 50s, became interested in the Zionist cause. He represented Jewish garment workers during a strike and was impressed by the intellectualism of these Eastern European immigrants and also their empathy, as well as those of their Jewish employers. And he also met Jacob de Haas, who is the American secretary of Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism. De Haas had remarked in passing that Louis Dembitz was a noble Jew. Louis Dembitz was Brandeis's favorite uncle, the only Orthodox Jew in the family, one of three Jews who voted for Abraham Lincoln at the Republican Convention of 1860. And once Brandeis learned that his revered uncle had been a Zionist, he began to read and think, and after a few years, convinced himself that the Jewish people needed a homeland because every nationality, as he called it, needed to be the majority in at least one country. So he became the head of the American Zionist movement, and within a few years, as you said, persuaded Woodrow Wilson and the British government through the Balfour Declaration to recognize a Jewish homeland in Palestine.
Talk about what you mean by American prophet. I recall from reading the book that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, also known as FDR, dubbed him Isaiah. Is that where you came up with the subtitle American prophet?
Yes, FDR called him Isaiah or my dear Isaiah. And many people remarked that he looked like a prophet. He had impressive gray hair and burning blue-gray eyes. But more importantly, he would often speak in a prophetic mode. He would denounce immorality, and he summoned FDR's advisors to his apartment and warned them that he was going to strike down the New Deal, paced across the room and said, morality is truth, and truth is morality, and it's been passed down through the generations, through Goethe and Euripides. But I also call him American prophet because he was so prophetic. His opinions about free speech and privacy are the most far-seeing of the 20th century and can tell us more about how to translate the Constitution in light of new technologies than any other Supreme Court opinions of their age.
In the book, you also say that, like Jefferson, Louis Brandeis said that the greatest threat to our constitutional liberties was an uneducated citizenry, and that democracy could not survive both ignorant and free. Tell me why this sort of resonates for me right now in our very polarized political climate.
Well, I'm glad that you drew that connection, because I agree that at this time of tremendous polarization, when America seems so fractured, it's so important to remember the lessons of Jefferson and Brandeis, who believed that the greatest threat to democracy is an inert people, as Brandeis so memorably put it in the Whitney case. Brandeis had a very arduous conception of democratic self-education. He thought, like Jefferson, that all of us have an obligation to develop our faculties. And by that, he embraced an Enlightenment idea that we all have certain faculties, from passion at the bottom to reason at the top. And only by rigorous self-education, by using our leisure time, which he, like the Greeks, defined as our moments of unemployment, could we master the facts that are necessary for full participation in American democracy. One of his favorite books, in addition to a great biography of Jefferson by Albert J. Nock, was a book by Alfred Zimmern, the British Zionist, called The Greek Polis. And Brandeis revered 5th century Athens and the idea of citizens deliberating together in small-scale communities, educating themselves in their leisure time, and mastering facts was, he thought, the key to the survival of liberty. And I agree with you that that message is very prescient today.
We'll talk more about that later. But also your emphasis, or his emphasis, on the use of leisure time. He was not a workaholic, right, in this Washingtonian sense. He always made time for leisure. He fit that into his schedule. I thought that was really terrific and a good lesson for all of us.
It is a good lesson. Brandeis said, I can do 12 months of work in 11 months, but not 12. He would set aside August to go to Cape Cod, where his family had a home. He loved the outdoors. He would hike and canoe. And he believed that you needed time away from work. he was so struck by the fact that the Greek word for leisure was, I'm going to mispronounce it, but aiskolai, which is unemployment as opposed to employment. And unemployment time is not supposed to be one for loafing around or watching cat videos or whatever we do today. It was supposed to be a time to improve yourself, to read Tolstoy, to master facts, to engage in disciplined self-education outside of your ordinary field. And that, today we call it work-life balance, but Brandeis took it seriously. He set aside time every morning to read to his daughters. He was a devoted husband. He thought that only with that Greek sense of a balanced life could we really achieve our full potential as citizens and human beings.
Now, you talk about the so-called Brandeis brief in your book. What is the Brandeis brief and why is it so important today?
Well, Brandeis called the Brandeis brief what every fool knows, but he was joking. The Brandeis brief was a collection of facts and empirical evidence designed for the first time in a case called Mueller in Oregon in 1908, to persuade the court to uphold maximum hour laws for women. And until Brandeis, people just had a lot of abstract legal arguments. But Brandeis had hundreds of pages of facts collected with his brilliant sister-in-law, Josephine Goldmark, that were so persuasive that the court actually cited the admirable work of Mr. Brandeis in showing that these laws were designed to protect women's health. These briefs were so inspiring that Thurgood Marshall, the great defender of African-American equality, and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the great defender of gender equality, viewed Brandeis' briefs as a model in their own work in fighting school segregation and gender discrimination.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Jeffrey Rosen. He's president and CEO of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia and author of the new book, Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Taufik Habu Zamzam. He's from Kano State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Jeffrey Rosen, to talk about Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. Now, you talked about his Jeffersonian legacy, but let's discuss to what extent he dealt with the issues of racial equality. I think on that issue, he was not as such an advocate. Talk about his legacy with respect to racial equality.
Yes, this is his blind spot. Of course, it was Jefferson's as well, although Jefferson's record on race is much more shameful than Brandeis's. Brandeis was not a racist. Unlike Woodrow Wilson, his patron, he didn't advocate for segregation in the federal government, but he was not a crusader for racial equality. And it's a notable absence in a prophetic activist who was so vocal about women's suffrage, which he'd initially opposed but came enthusiastically to support, as well as economic equality. I speculate that this may have had something to do with his Southern upbringing. He was born in 1856. He remembered hearing Confederate shot at the Second Battle of Bull Run. His mother was an abolitionist. And although he was courteous to African-Americans and advised African-American lawyers on a few occasions, he silently joined the court in all the race cases that came before him, didn't write separately, and was not a leader. And I think this has to be acknowledged as a blind spot for this tribune of liberty and equality.
Indeed, a blind spot, especially because Brandeis, being a minority himself, a Jew, it just seems a little bit dissonant that he was not more progressive on racial issues.
It does, and it's striking that the tradition of Southern economic populism that Brandeis is so distinguished a member of, which began with Jefferson and Jackson and then Wilson and Brandeis and Franklin Roosevelt, culminating in Harry Truman, most of these are Southerners, Southern white men, who do not have progressive or enlightened views about race. It's unfortunate. Of course, nowadays Hamilton is the rock star of the moment in America because of this hit Broadway musical. And the fact that Jefferson and his heirs were not as far-seeing on race has limited their appeal. I hope that it's possible to resurrect the admirable parts of their legacy, in particular their crusading opposition to monopoly power, to the curse of bigness, to corporate influence, which was such a crucial part of American history, while at the same time acknowledging their blind spot on race.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of Hamilton, let's talk about the contrast between Hamilton and Jefferson in light of the curse of bigness in government and the private sector, because I recall from the book that you contrast the two, especially in light of a recent recession we had in 2008. We had the banks and this concept of too big to fail. Discuss Brandeis's legacy in that regard and how you see it applied or not applied today.
Well, there's no subject on which Brandeis is more prophetic than economic risk, and in particular the risk that greedy oligarchic bankers take with what Brandeis unforgettably called other people's money. That was the title of a book he wrote in 1913, which denounced J.P. Morgan, the Bank of Morgan, for investing in complicated financial instruments that were too ornate for anyone to understand their value. Sound familiar? Essentially, he anticipated the credit default swaps that led to the crash of 2008. And Brandeis thought that because Morgan assumed all of the benefits of these bets and none of the risks, that he would take risks that would ultimately lead to financial ruin, and he was vindicated by the crash of 1929. Brandeis's solution to the curse of bigness was to break up the banks, and we're hearing echoes of that in the campaign trail in America today. It was unfortunate that Bernie Sanders attributed his proposal to break up the banks to Theodore Roosevelt, because actually it was Brandeis and Wilson who wanted to break up the banks. Theodore Roosevelt preferred to create large regulatory agencies to oversee the big banks, and that kind of bigness was anathema to Brandeis. In the wake of the crash of 1929, although the first New Deal breathed the spirit of Theodore Roosevelt and the new nationalism, the second New Deal, as the historian Arthur Schlesinger put it, breathed the spirit of Brandeis and Wilson and the new freedom. And after Brandeis voted to strike down the centralizing agencies of the first New Deal, his acolytes in the Roosevelt administration championed reforms like the separation of commercial from investment banking in the Glass-Steagall Act that maintained financial stability until it was repealed in the 1990s and led to the crash of 2008. So it's tremendously useful for understanding our current financial vexations. And I think that Brandeis would have approved, in the wake of the latest crash, at the very least, the Volcker Rule, as it's called, which prohibits big banks from engaging in proprietary tradings on their own accounts.
But not necessarily the so-called Dodd-Frank Act, which perhaps Brandeis would think did not go far enough.
Exactly right. He would have applauded the capitalization requirements in Dodd-Frank, which required the banks to keep a certain amount of cash on hand. But I think he would have preferred to break up the banks. That was his solution after 29. He wanted to break them up so they could be taxed by the states. And he would have been disappointed that proposals to essentially break up the banks failed, because the Republican and Democratic parties in the U.S. today are more Hamiltonian than Jeffersonian.
Hamiltonian, again, more central government focus.
Exactly. Hamilton was an advocate of an energetic executive. Some thought he wanted a king and a strong central government. Jefferson, an opponent of both concentrated executive and legislative authority, proposed a constitutional amendment that would have limited corporations by prohibiting Congress from setting up monopolies or corporations with exclusive advantages of trade. So this tension, this debate throughout American constitutional history about whether or not the federal government should be strong and centralized or constrained and decentralized traces back to Hamilton and Jefferson. And we're seeing traces of the old Jeffersonian spirit today, both among the civil libertarian left, which fears NSA surveillance, and the libertarian right, which also doesn't like a big central government. So I'm hoping that Brandeis's hour perhaps may come around at last.
And how would you characterize Brandeis's judicial philosophy per se? Because you talk a lot about the fact that he was in favor of judicial restraint and, of course, respecting state laws to the extent they were valid. Talk about that concept of judicial restraint.
Absolutely right. Brandeis famously argued that the court should defer to the states as laboratories of democracy and should hesitate to strike down state laws unless they clearly and unequivocally clashed with explicit protections in the U.S. Constitution. At the same time, he wrote the greatest defenses of free speech and privacy of the 20th century and was willing to strike down laws that he thought clashed with explicit constitutional protections. In the end, I think Brandeis struck down laws that he didn't like the New Deal, and upheld those that he did, like state regulation. So I'm not sure he had a strong independent commitment to judicial deference that transcended his very powerful vision of political economy. But he is a powerful model for libertarian conservatives today who think that the states should generally have free rein to rule and that the federal government should be more constrained.
So where would that place him on the spectrum today on the Supreme Court? Liberal, conservative, swing, justice?
There's no Brandeisian on the current court. Progressive advocate of states' rights and federalism is an unusual combination. Three of the justices told me that Brandeis is their hero, and I had the privilege of interviewing them for the book, Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, and Elena Kagan, and they all praised him for different reasons. Justice Ginsburg for the Brandeis brief and for his great candor, Justice Breyer for his pragmatism, and Justice Kagan for his heroic free speech opinion in Whitney versus California. And by the way, I'm a law professor, so here's a homework assignment for your listeners. Everyone, please read Brandeis's opinion in Whitney versus California. It's the greatest free speech opinion ever written in American history, and I guarantee you'll be inspired by it.
Well, I'll put that down for my own homework myself.
It's great. Well,
Jeffrey Rosen, speaking of free speech, let's go to the various issues that face us today, especially concerning how to balance privacy and national security, threats to free speech and privacy in this age of the internet. How do you think Brandeis would deal with these issues today?
Well, on the question of privacy, it's so interesting. Brandeis had initially, in 1890, written the most famous article on the right to privacy and defended a European conception of basically a right of dignity or honor, a right of celebrities to sue the press for publishing truthful but embarrassing information about them. And he was concerned about new technologies like the Kodak camera and the instant press. But Brandeis came to change his mind about privacy. He came to believe that the right of dignity or honor that he championed in that article, and that we're now seeing in Europe in decisions like the European Court's new right to be forgotten, he believed that the right clashed with free speech, clashed with the right and the duty of the press to publish truthful information, no matter how embarrassing. And therefore, in the transformative opinion, Whitney versus California, Brandeis came to argue that all speech, no matter how hateful, no matter how much of an indignity it caused, as long as it was truthful, should be allowed into the public debate so that citizens could make up their own mind about how to govern themselves. And that helped him embrace a conception of intellectual privacy, as the scholar Neil Richards calls it, that was threatened by government surveillance. So he opposed wiretapping. A majority of the court upheld warrantless wiretapping in the 1920s. But Brandeis, in this incredibly far-seeing and prescient opinion, looks forward to the age of cyberspace and imagines a day, and that day is our day, by which the government, without physically intruding into secret desk drawers, could extract papers and introduce them in court. He anticipates Skype. He imagines a two-way technology where people can see each other through two ends of a camera. And Brandeis says, at the time of the framing, general warrants that allowed the king to rummage through private papers sparked the American Revolution. Therefore, any technology, and I think NSA surveillance would be part of it, that allows the government to collect a great deal of information on citizens without cause threatens that privacy and needs to be constrained. So for all these reasons, I think he would have viewed NSA surveillance without a warrant as unconstitutional, and perhaps even with a warrant, because he thought that it was the value of freedom of thought and opinion and the ability to control the expression of our unexpressed thoughts, sensations, and emotions that was at the heart both of the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures, and the First Amendment, which protects freedom of thought and opinion.
Even in the face of the threats that we face, international terrorism and the need to protect ourselves, even under those circumstances, he would be a staunch privacy advocate.
Brandeis is a pragmatist, and with concrete and individualized suspicion of a serious threat, I think he would have allowed for targeted surveillance. He said in his great free speech opinion, that the test for when speech can be banned is it has to be intended to and likely to cause imminent violence. It's a remarkably rigorous standard that sets America apart from the rest of the world. Your listeners will perhaps write in if I'm wrong, but I don't know of another country that protects free speech so vigorously, allows the expression of hate speech, and insists on a close connection between the speech and the possibility of imminent lawless action. So if the threat is serious and the cause is specific, I think that he would have allowed surveillance, but without meeting that rigorous standard, he wouldn't.
I think you're probably absolutely right with that regard, how unique the United States is in terms of right to privacy and free speech. Let's move to today, Jeffrey Rosen. As we look at the Supreme Court, we have 8 justices. One is missing as a result of the death of Antonin Scalia. President Obama has nominated Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court, but the Republicans have refused to grant him confirmation hearings. How unusual is this current situation historically, where you have a president, even if he's in his last year of his last term, he's trying to fulfill a vacancy on the Supreme Court, and you have the Senate refusing to grant him confirmation hearings?
Brandeis waited 125 days between his nomination on January 28, 1916, and his confirmation on June 1, 1916. So far as we speak, that record has been unsurpassed, but Merrick Garland will surpass that record on July 19th. Now, Brandeis did, of course, get a hearing. His opposition was focused partly on anti-Semitism. There was veiled criticism of him for being Jewish, but the main opposition really came from the fact that he was perceived to be a radical who had opposed corporate interests. Nowadays, our politics are different. Brandeis faced a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president. We now have a split government. I think all we can say is that things have gotten progressively more polarized since Brandeis was confirmed with a comfortable majority. And what other lessons can Brandeis say about Garland? Well, one is that justices can change on the bench. Brandeis was perceived to be a radical, but he proved to be on the bench a team player, and he buried the hatchet with one of his nemeses, President William Howard Taft, who denounced him during his confirmation as being a socialist and a muckraker, but then was appointed Chief Justice, and he and Brandeis joined together because of their shared concern about the institutional legitimacy of the court and the importance of unanimity. That suggests that even those who fear that Merrick Garland might be a wild-eyed liberal, an implausible fear, may be surprised by his attachment to pragmatism and the team dynamic if he were to join the court.
How important do you believe the Supreme Court appointments will be in this upcoming presidential election?
There's no more important issue in this upcoming presidential election. The National Constitution Center, which I have the privilege to head, is a nonpartisan institution, so I'm not taking any sides on who should win the presidential election. But I can say with complete confidence that anyone who is eligible to vote in the U.S. presidential election should cast his or her vote to the candidate whose view of the Constitution and the Supreme Court best coincides with their own, because this is an election, as you said, that will, by filling the seat left vacant by the late Justice Scalia, determine whether we have a liberal or a conservative court for possibly decades to come. And the next president is likely to have one or two or even more appointments. And this will transform constitutional law to a degree that it has not seen for a very long time indeed.
Do you think the Supreme Court has become more of a political issue in recent elections than it has been historically?
Well, the Supreme Court has always been highly politicized. Nominations have been as far back as the election of 1800. The incoming Republicans were denied the right to make a nomination by the outgoing Federalist Congress, which reduced the size of the Supreme Court, so Thomas Jefferson couldn't make any appointments. But it is true that since the 1980s in the U.S., since the failed nomination of Robert Bork to the Supreme Court, confirmation hearings have become more and more hotly contested. And the court has also involved itself in more issues, from affirmative action to abortion to campaign finance to voting rights, in a way that has thrust itself into the vortex of the American political debate.
The book is Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. The author, Jeffrey Rosen, he's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. Jeffrey, thank you for your precious time and terrific insights.
Thank you. It was wonderful to talk.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anya Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Vasco Volorić. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Most of us like to be out in the sun. That's why sunscreen and other safety measures are key to protecting your skin from aging and cancer. The FDA recommends using a sunscreen with an SPF of 15 or higher. Also, look for broad spectrum on the label. That means both harmful ultraviolet A and B rays are blocked. Remember, SPF plus broad spectrum equal healthy fun in the sun. Visit www.fda.gov/sunscreen for more information. A message from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
Tune in each weekday morning at 6. Tom Temin brings you the latest agency news from across the government, reports on congressional action, and developments affecting your pay and benefits. Hear interviews with people making, analyzing, and helping you understand the news. Start off your weekday informed and stimulated. It's The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, weekday mornings at 6 here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
This is Jared Serbu. I'm tweeting daily about the news that's interesting and important to the armed services and the defense contractors who serve them. Follow me at JSerbu, WFED.
WFED Washington, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas, WTLP FM HD2 Braddock Heights Frederick, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics.